Torah Way, Northwest London, Tuesday, Beis de Chol HaMoed Sukkos, 3rd of October, Rabbi Akiva Tatz Shlita on Jewish genetics. This week's Torah Way has been sponsored by Family Moss on the 14th yahrzeit of our dear friend and Torah Way participant, Rabbi Yosef ben Rabbi Avraham Moss, Zichron Levrocha.
Okay, thank you to Torah Way for this chance to learn a bit together. And my compliments to Torah Way. Quite amazing that they managed to have Torah every single day. Quite amazing, and they force people to come and talk. But let's talk a little bit about Jewish genetics, which is, you probably know that modern medicine today is based entirely on genetics, or what they call genomics. That is the deepest level of understanding we have today of how the biological world works. And there are some fascinating breaking news, if you like, in the genetic world. A few years ago, we began to speak about some of these issues, and some of those things have advanced further. There's recently discovered a Jewish gene, Ashkenazi Jewish gene. We cannot tell if you're an authentic Ashkenazi Jew by looking at your genes. And many other fascinating developments. You've probably heard about the Yemenite children, that have the accusation of Yemenite children taken away from their parents in the 1950s, 1960s. The graves of those children now being opened by a law that passed by the Knesset last year to check whether, in fact, the story is true, were those children actually taken away, were they not. And as we speak, that genetic work is being done. So there are many very broad applications of genes and genetics in Judaism. Let me cover in the short time that we have a few of the more interesting and perhaps slightly newer ones, and show you some of the fascination of this area. The first question that's being asked, and this already goes back a couple of decades, is whether you can identify people from their genes. So that would apply to, for example, a dead body, what we call forensics, in a murder investigation, or from a purely halakhic point of view, we have a body or part of a body, we need to know where to bury that person. We need to identify a person as in fact having died. Can his wife remarry? Or is she a woman who can't marry because we don't know if the husband's died? Many, many, almost countless applications of identifying body parts or dead bodies. So how do we approach this from a genetic point of view? I'm sure you know that the classic approach to identifying a body, let's take the standard and classical case of a woman whose husband has disappeared, and we need to know whether she can remarry. Has, in fact, her husband died? Or maybe he's living in the Bahamas with a new flame, you know, and he's still alive. In which case, she'd not be allowed to marry. So the question is, how do we identify the body? So the classic identification is witnesses need to see the body, including the face, including the central part of the face and the nose. And they need to testify that the person is the person who he's supposed to be. And then she would be allowed to remarry. What happens if the body is not, you cannot see the face? What would happen then in halacha? So we have a thing called simonim. Simonim means identifying features. You find this, for example, in the mitzvah of Hashavas Avedah. If I find an object, you claim it's yours, I don't show it to you, you tell me some identifying marks on the object. If you are accurate, I give back your object. Such things could possibly be used in such circumstances to identify a body. Now, the problem is we need good enough simonim. So in halacha, we have three levels of simon. We have what's called a simon mufak, which is a very high-level simon. That means something so unusual that it's almost impossible to imagine that it would not be the object in question. Then we have a simon beinoni, which is something that's unusual but not that unusual. Then we have run-of-the-mill simonim, which would not be very, very uniquely identifying. Now, to identify a body, we need a simon muvak. We need something that is incredibly unlikely to be the wrong person. The gold standard in forensic medicine today, in crime scene investigations and so on, traditionally the gold standard has been dental records. Because good dentists keep meticulous records of their patients, and every dental pattern is slightly different. And so a good dentist documenting the dental pattern will be a good record. And the reason it's used in forensic medicine is because not only is it unique to each dental patient, but the teeth survive fires and acid attacks, and so even when the rest of the body is badly decomposed, very often the teeth will still be identifiable. Today, they are way beyond teeth. Today they're using genes. Now, what is the level of accuracy of a genetic identification? So how do we approach this in halacha? If you look in halachic literature over the last 500 years, you will see that although going back further than that, in the Gemara, for example, there's no statistical measure of a siman. Right? You know that we are quite skeptical about statistics in halacha. We have a concept of a rave and a miut, and a miut that's matsu, you're not matsu. We have things like that. But using statistics, which modern science is totally based on, is in somewhat a little hesitant to do that in halacha. And therefore, the Gemara doesn't give a statistical measure of how unusual a siman has to be a siman muvak. But for the last 500 years, you look in halachic literature, the poskim have generally accepted 1 in 1,000. 1 in 1,000, right? Which means that 1 in 1,000, Rabbi Yashiv used to use this in some circumstances, in some medical circumstances. 1 in 1,000 is regarded as being so unlikely, if it's less, that means if it's less likely than 1 in 1,000, that would be a high level siman, right? Now, the question, what would be a siman like that? I don't know, maybe some unusual tattoo, even though maybe Jews are not allowed to be tattooed, but today we have a whole world of Balei Tshuva, many of whom come in with tattoos, very embarrassing sometimes. They're very embarrassing tattoos. It's a major issue to have them removed. You know, it's very, very... So. But tattoos could be a unique tattoo. I'll never forget, I might have mentioned this before, when I was a young doctor starting out in practice, I had a young fellow come into my examination room. He jumped up on the examination couch, took off his shirt to be examined. He had a tattoo down his arm. Becky crossed out, Elizabeth crossed out, Gemma, you know, I think Becky featured twice, you know, you'd think you'd get the message, but since you can't erase, you just got to keep adding, you know. So the thing about a tattoo is that it cannot be erased. So what would be a siman that would be that sort of level of identification? So 1 in 1,000. Now DNA identification is like 1 in 10 million. Way better than 1 in 1,000. And yet it's new, so we don't have Psak halacha going back hundreds of years. How do we approach that, right? 1 in 10 million. By the way, 1 in 10 million is not absolute, right? For example, in American courtroom dramas, there have been situations where the jury's been told that the chance the accused is the wrong person is less than 1 in 10 million. But that still means 30 or 40 Americans could have done the crime. You get through 400 million people. So 1 in 10 million is not absolute, but it's way better than 1 in 1,000. But it's new, it's newfangled, you can't see it, there's room for lab error, DNA contamination occurs very easily, even somebody handling the sample, their DNA can get into it. So how do we approach that? So I'll tell you the state of the art. Rav Asher Weiss, for example, has been going along these lines for quite some time. Actually, I personally had a discussion with a London-based in some time ago where they wanted to use DNA for partial, that means as an additional information to use in certain halachic decisions, not to use it absolutely. And the state of the art today seems to be that a modern poskim have been using DNA identification provided there is what they call raglaim ledavar. Raglaim ledavar means that there is corroborating evidence on which to base the DNA evidence. For example, perhaps the groundbreaking psak that was given in this field that set the tone for the field was when the people were killed in the 9/11 attacks. Almost no bodies were recovered. But there was a part of a body that was found that was thought to belong to a Jewish man from New York, but all they found was a small part of the body. They took DNA from that body part and it perfectly matched hair in his hairbrush in his home in New York. But in addition to that, he'd been speaking to his wife on the phone when the building was attacked. He said, "Something going on, we don't know what it is," and he was never heard from again. She was allowed to remarry. Why? Raglaim ledavar. That means we know he was in the building speaking to his wife. Plus, the DNA matched perfectly. So that is where the poskim are holding more or less today. It could well be, we could well enter an era where they will accept that as fully definitive evidence, but that's more or less the issue. There's a psak in the writings of Rav Osher about a young man who wanted to marry a woman whom a Kohen may not marry, and his father's a Kohen. But it's not 100% clear that his father's his father. There was a confused adoption story in the family that no one could clarify. And he wants to marry the girl. Rav Asher allowed them to test him genetically. And the test proves with almost absolute certainty that he's not, in fact, the genetic son, the biological son of that man. And Rav Asher allowed him to marry the girl. Why? Raglaim ledavar, there was already a story in the family. Plus the genes proved that, in fact, he's not the biological son of that individual. So that is more or less where we're holding today in terms of identifying individuals. I mentioned the Yemenite children. That is a tragic story that you probably know. In the 1950s and 1960s, Yemenites were brought to Israel. Many of them, thousands of them, in fact, housed in 10 cities around the country. And tragically, a number of children disappeared. What happened was when babies were admitted to Israeli hospitals, and this happened, there are literally hundreds of children, their children disappeared. When the parents came to visit the baby, they were told, your child died, we couldn't wait for you, your child's buried, and they told them where the children were buried. And the accusation is that the hospitals gave away those babies or sold them, very often to Holocaust surviving families who didn't have children. That is what happened. And in the Yemenite community today, that is widely accepted. I gave a shiur when a Yemenite fellow came up to me after the shiur to tell me that when he was born, his mother walked out of the hospital 2 hours after he was born because his aunt had given birth 2 days before. And when she went to the nursery to look for a baby, the baby wasn't there. And they told her the baby died. So when his mother gave birth 2 days later, she walked out of the hospital with a newborn child in her arms because of that. And it's never been clarified. Commission after commission have been set up by the Israeli government in order to get to the bottom of this, and it's never been fully resolved. So the Knesset last year passed a law mandating opening the graves of those babies, and I don't think there was much halachic obstruction there, to open the graves of those supposed graves of those babies to see whether the babies buried there are in fact the children, although the parents are often no longer alive, but many siblings are. And we can tell from genetic investigation whether the baby buried there is or is not a brother of the families who were claimed to have those babies taken away. And the first grave was opened about 2 or 3 months ago. And as we speak, they are now investigating the DNA of that first child to see whether, in fact, and to lay to rest and bring closure to this very bitter episode in modern Israeli history. It's not so simple because the graves are very small. Not only that, as you know, people in Israel are not buried in coffins except for soldiers. And so the ground has shifted and graves have moved. It's not so simple. You're talking about many years. In many cases, many babies were buried in the same grave. So not so simple. But there's great hope that with modern genetics, we'll be able to bring closure to that issue. So that's another example of identification of individuals. More interestingly, probably, is a more recent development, and that is a Jewish gene. This is a fascinating story, and that is that we can now identify groups of people, this is known as population genetics, where we can see who comes from what, which areas and who's related to whom. If you'd like to read a good book on this, good Chol HaMoed reading, two books I recommend. One is called Legacy by Professor Harry Ostrer, O-S-T-R-E-R, who is a professor of, I think, pediatrics and genetics at Yeshiva University. And the other book that's very interesting is called, I think it's called DNA, the Evidence by Rabbi Kleiner, if I'm not mistaken, who Kleiner. He is a rabbi and Cohen in the Old City, who's written a book about the Kohanic gene, which I'll tell you a little bit about as well. Those are two fascinating books. The second book is more readable, the other's a bit more academic and technical, but both very readable. Now, before I tell you about the population genetics of the Jewish gene, let me just remind you about the Kohanic gene. You know that there's a thing called the CMH, Cohen Model Haplotype. It's a genetic pattern unique to Kohanim. How was this discovered? Some years ago, Dr. Carl Skarecki, who is a doctor and a Cohen. Today, I think he was actually living in Toronto at the time. Today, I think he's the dean of the medical school in Beersheba, if I'm not mistaken. But then he was a doctor, an academic doctor living in Toronto, and is a Kohen. And one Shabbos morning, he was sitting in shul, and he noticed them calling up for Kohen a Yemenite. Now, the Yemenite looks like a Yemenite, he has those features, and Skarecki has a, you know, he looks like a Canadian Ashkenazi Jew. They look very different. But when he saw this Kohen having his aliyah, he suddenly said to himself, one second, if he's a Kohen and I'm a Kohen, this means we descended from the same man. That's what it means to be a Kohen. We descended from Aaron HaKohen, who lived over 3,000 years ago, and that's what it means. And then he suddenly realized that we can now prove this genetically. For the first time in history, we can actually prove who is descended from whom over countless generations. As long as there's been a father-to-son transmission that's been unbroken, right, if we can find part of the genetic code that you get only from your father, then we could tell in an unbroken line, we could confirm who you are descended from. I won't bore you with the technicalities, but the way it's done is, you know that when you're trying to tell parentage, the trouble is when you look at the genome of an individual, you never know which part came from the father, which from the mother. Because father and mother's genes zip together, right, forming the double-stranded DNA in every child, and you never know which mix and match components come from whom. But if you could find a line that came only from the father, you'd have a unbroken, clear lineage. So it so happens, as I'm sure you all know, in the DNA of each individual, there are Y, there's an X and Y chromosome on the sex-identifying, gender-identifying parts of the yes, in these generations, those seems to got a little bit mixed up. But anyway, the point is that there's an X and a Y. Now, the Y chromosome you get only from your father. So there's no mixing and matching. To be a male means you have the Y chromosome, and that's handed down, unmodified, and unbroken from father to son. So Skarecki realized, well, if we check the Y chromosome, and we find that all Kohanim have unique features, we can then assume that they are genetically distinct. So what did he do? He wanted to find hundreds of Kohanim at one time and place. Where do you go for that?
Kosel.
You go to the Kosel on Chol HaMoed, and that's what he did. And at Birkas Kohanim at the Kosel, he had a party with hundreds of Kohanim. He invited anyone who claimed to be a Kohen. He required no corroboration other than the individual said that their father told them they were a Kohen. He took a little swab from inside their cheek, a little bit of genetic material, and he analyzed the genes, and he found that a very, very high proportion of people claiming to be Kohanim today have a unique genetic pattern, which means clearly that they're descended from one individual. Not only that, we can use genetics today to tell not only that you descended from the same individual, but how many generations have gone by exactly between that individual and you. How we do that, again, without going into too much in the technicalities, is that if you have, for example, let's say you have two brothers. The two brothers will have almost identical DNA. Not 100%, because in every generation there's a slight mutation. That's called the standard mutation rate. So let's say parents with one set of genes, the twins in certain segments of their DNA will have DNA that's almost the same, but there's a, let's say, one click of the molecular clock every generation. So in every reproduction, there'll be one, let's call it error, mutation, and a slight difference. In cousins, in the next generation, there'll be two clicks of the clock. And in the third generation, three clicks of the clock. Which means by taking any two individuals and measuring the clicks of the clock difference between them, we can tell exactly how many generations have gone by from a common ancestor. Now, we can't tell how many years necessarily, because that depends how old people were when they were having their children. The Gemara says there were times of people having children at age 8. So you'd have to make assumptions about the age at which people were reproducing. But how many generations we can tell with precision. So which means that if you take the Kohanim alive today and you see the clicks of the clock, we can tell, first of all, that they're all Kohanim because they have these six unique features in the Y chromosome. We can also tell how many clicks of the clock have taken place since the common ancestor. So he gave the work to a research team at Oxford. You should read it. Fascinating, fascinating work. Non-Jewish researchers. And they came to the conclusion that Kohanim today are descended from one man who lived, they say, 2,000 years ago. We would dispute that. We'd say it's a little over 3,000. But it's not too bad. And again, they're making assumptions about the time. And that is what they say. It's a fascinating corroboration of the Kohen story. Some consequences of this were unexpected. If you look in the academic study, you'll find, I think, a very moving insertion. The final paragraph is, this proves conclusively that people of Jewish lineage today claiming to be Kohanim are indeed descended from one individual who lived a couple thousand years ago. But before that, there's one insertion, a by the way comment which these non-Jewish researchers made, which brought tears to my eyes. They say, we unexpectedly found an incidental finding here. And what was that? An unprecedented level of marital fidelity among the Jewish people. You know what that means? You're talking about 3,000 years of lineage, father to son. If one woman in 3,000 years had been unfaithful to her husband and conceived the child by someone else unknown to the husband, you've broken the line. The discrepancy was 2%. Again, you're talking about over 3,000 years with all the rapes and pillages and all we've been through, right? That the unbroken line of women faithful, at least Kohanim, don't ask me about that, but at least Kohanim. And they said, we have never seen a population with this type of a story, right? Unbelievable thing. Not only does it prove that they're descended from the same person, but of course there are Catholic men in Spain and Portugal who have the gene. Why? Because it's father to son. I don't know who you marry. So these people got lost probably during the Spanish expulsion. They're practicing Catholics going to church today. And indeed, they're probably not Jewish. But they have the Kohanic gene, because another peculiar outcome of this is that I was raised in South Africa, where lots of good things come from. And there is a tribe in South Africa called the Lemba people. The Lembas are black South Africans. I mean, they are black, as you know, they are Negroid black people. Okay, they claim to be Jewish. It's a tribe in the northeastern, what used to be called the Transvaal, and they have some Jewish relics, and they claim to be Jewish. They say they descended from Yemenites who traded through Africa marrying converted women over the centuries. Now, I was a teenager in South Africa, and we thought that was a joke. I mean, these people don't look Jewish, right? We know what Jews are. They're not Jewish. Not only that, they have a clan among them called the Buba clan that they claim are Kohanim. We thought that was even funnier. Well, Skarecki tested them, and they have the Kohen gene. There's going to be some interesting surprises when the Mashiach comes about who is Jewish. In fact, probably Yemenites moved through Africa from Yemen, and indeed converted women and married them. And so these people there's a whole story about accepting them as Jews with the criteria we need today. But nevertheless, and if you'd like to see photographs of these people and their relics and so on in Kleinman's book that I mentioned, DNA, he actually has photographs and interviews of them, and you can actually see the Lemba people story. So that is the lineage of Kohanim, and that's known as the CMH or Cohen haplotype, which is unique genetically. While we're on that subject, we should also mention that something even more interesting probably is that as soon as people got wind of this genetic clock, this molecular clock mechanism, they started realizing we can check lineages in all sorts of ways. So non-Jews, completely non-Jewish research, decided to see how many ancestors are there of all humans on Earth today. We can do that. We can take humans from across the planet, and we can check molecular clock distinctions, provided we can find an unbroken lineage where there's no mixing and matching. So they decided to check the maternal lineage, and here's where we come to the Jewish gene, because you need a gene from your mother, right, if you want to be diagnosed as Jewish. But before we get to the Jews, they decided to check humans on Earth. So what did they do? They decided to check maternal chromosomes, maternal genes. Now, there is one part of your genome that you get only from your mother. And that happens to be a set of genes in what are known as mitochondria. You know, in the cell, I'm sure you all remember your high school biology perfectly. You'll remember that the cell has a nucleus in the center with about 25,000 genes. And then outside the nucleus, tiny little organelles called mitochondria, which produce energy for the cell. For unknown reasons, there's some DNA in the mitochondria. They're not involved in reproduction in the way that the nucleus is. But nevertheless, there's about 21 to 30 genes in the mitochondria. And those you get only from your mother. When the egg is fertilized, the father's mitochondria are deleted. And all daughter cells in the resulting organism, the mitochondria carry DNA only from your mother. Which means we have a way of investigating maternal lineage. So here's what they did. They took a little snippet of placenta from babies being born throughout the world. I'm talking about the whole world, Papua New Guinea and South America. And they analyzed the genes in the mitochondria. Now, hold on to your seat for this. It turns out that all humans on Earth are descended from one woman. They call her Mitochondrial Eve. They say she lived about 200,000 years ago. Now, we would dispute that, but it's a lot better than the 2 billion they were talking about before. Okay? And if you look at this, by the way, look it up yourself. You find this easily on the internet. Two different academic teams in America who investigated this thing coming to the same conclusion. And what's amazing is the final paragraph in both these studies is, this proves conclusively that all humans on Earth today descend from one woman. And then there's a final paragraph. Of course, we know this is ridiculous and impossible. There were many, many pre-human ape-like creatures. We know that. What must have happened was there must have been many hominid ape-like creatures on the planet. And for some unknown reason, only one lucky female turned out to be the one from whom we all descended today. As we say right observation, wrong interpretation. But be that as it may, that is the genetic lineage that can be checked today. And that's what's been used for humans. Now, what about Ashkenazi? So some years ago, they found an Ashkenazi gene. Again, work is now being done in Bukharian Jews and others, but to date, we've only found an identifying feature in Ashkenazi Jews, and of course, it's found in the mitochondria. We want a maternal lineage for this. We want a paternal lineage for Kohanim. We want a maternal lineage for Jews. And indeed, a unique haplotype, a genetic pattern, has been found that is very much more expressed in Ashkenazi Jews than people around the world. If you'd like to see the research on this and how we are related to whom, in Ostra's book he has fascinating population maps. Most Ashkenazi Jews today are most closely related genetically to Tuscan Italians. Almost Italians. Almost certainly during the expulsion, right, in the Second Temple destruction, there were about four men, it's thought, whose genes came down to us today, intermarrying with converted Roman women, right? And therefore, second to that is Greeks, third to that is French. Very interesting to see the map of genetic lineage where we come from. We look very different than people from Sephardi countries and Yemenites, right? So clearly there's genetic mixing. We don't claim to be a racial aristocracy. We claim to be a spiritual aristocracy, right? Nothing racially. We have Jews of all colors and shapes and sizes. So that is the... So they found this marker among Ashkenazi Jews. This is not yet being accepted as enough to identify you as Jewish. The base thing that I mentioned before, working on certain people, mostly from the former Soviet Union, where they claim to be Jewish, with very strong anecdotal evidence, but no documented evidence, they were now considering using in certain of these stories. Could we incorporate genetic information to tell maybe that these people are Jewish as well? What have been the applications of this? I'll tell you. One is that the chief rabbi of Rome today, of all places, where we think most of the concentrated right lineage began after the Roman exile, the chief rabbi of Rome, whose name is Rabbi Riccardo Di Seni, who happens to be a Jew descended probably from Jewish families 2,000 years ago in Italy. You know, many Italian Jews come from Algeria, other places, but there's a lineage that comes all the way back from the Second Temple times. Rabbi Di Seni is not only the chief rabbi of Rome, he's also a doctor, as the best rabbis are. And he became aware that in Rome, there are three places where bones have been discovered which are thought to be Jewish. There are Greek and Hebrew inscriptions, and it's not clear if these are Jewish. They're not graves, they are stone containers, right, with bones inside. Rabbi Di Seni wanted to know if he'd be allowed to take a little bit of bone to test genetically. DNA is an incredibly long-surviving molecule. You can take DNA from 5,000-year-old bodies and identify them today, right? Yeah, amazing. From inside the teeth or inside the bones. And he asked the Poskim in Eretz Yisrael, would he be allowed to take bone? Now, we don't move bones for anything. We don't move graves for anything. The only reason we'll ever move a grave is for Kivrei Avos, to bury a person with family under certain circumstances, and under unusual circumstances to move somebody to Israel. But and even then, only under limited circumstances, we don't mess with graves. To mess around with bones and start moving them, Rav Asher Weiss, who was asked in this case, was very unhappy. And what he did was, in one of the areas where the bodies are lying, he allowed them to take teeth. There are loose teeth around there as well. And as we speak, they're analyzing the DNA in those teeth to see whether those bodies are Jewish. In another place in Rome, one is near the river, one is under where Mussolini's headquarters used to be, in one place up to 1,000 skeletons being discovered. Before they touch the bones, they notice they're all buried like this. Now, non-Jews are always buried like this. And all these bodies, in fact, an unusual custom, anyone here in the Chaver Kedusha? They notice that they're all buried like this, right? No, there's some new custom, maybe for not familiar to us, but all buried. And on the basis of that, they're almost sure that these are Jewish bodies. In Bologna, there is a Jewish cemetery, which has been there for 500 years. But in 1560, the Jews were expelled from Bologna. You know, it was a conglomeration of city-states, and that particular area, you know, Jews have been exiled from everywhere. Mm-hmm. And so the families were exiled from Bologna. The rich families took their dead with them. But poor people left the bodies, and they are still buried in Bologna. Now, for the last 500 years, a convent was built next to the Jewish cemetery, and the non-Jews from the convent, the nuns from the convent, have been buried on top of the Jews. You know, there are many cemeteries in Europe where there are layers, right? Many shilas, interesting shilas. If you go to Prague, you'll see the Jewish cemetery in Prague is actually mounded because there are 4, 5, or 6 graves stacked on top of each other, right? And therefore, there are layered graves. The community there recently wanted to know whether they could use DNA from the bodies to see where the non-Jewish bodies... They want to restore the cemetery and take care of it. They want to know where the non-Jewish bodies end and the Jewish bodies begin. But before they considered taking that, they noticed that every skeleton of a non-Jew, each one of them, has a ring on the finger with a crucifix. So they know exactly where the non-Jewish bodies end and the Jews only take any DNA. That solved the problem. Anyway, these are some of the fascinating areas that are involved with modern genetics. So the new areas today are, one is the Yemenite children, the genes are being used. Another one is many, many dramatic scenarios where bodies are found, and we need to know who they are with respect to avelus, to inheritance, to marriage, all sorts of consequences that are contingent upon this. That is another area. Since we run out of time, let me just mention very briefly one other. Again, there are many other fascinating areas. Today we have the ability to actually modify genes, as you probably know. We can actually take diseased genes and edit them out of the genome and edit healthy genes in. Okay, Nobel Prize was won, I think, last year by two lady researchers who had developed the CRISPR technique. We can now actually take people with genetic problems and we can actually correct the genes, not just treat with medications. We can actually correct the coding, so to speak. So that is a brave new world, and again, there's no halakhic reason that shouldn't be done, really, and many other novelties. But one of them that's perhaps most important practically to walk away with is the knowledge that we are very important to do premarital genetic screening. And anyone listening to this sure needs to note that if you are considering marrying or you have children, and you're probably going to interfere with your children's choices anyway, and probably with your grandchildren's choices of whom they marry, you might as well interfere correctly. And so if you're a shadchan, you work with people, it's very important to know that we have a range of genetic diseases in the Ashkenazi community. Sephardim have also a range of issues which are not as unique to them, but Ashkenazi Jews certainly have a list of 10 or 11 quite common and some very common genetic diseases. Tay-Sachs is the most famous, but we also have cystic fibrosis and familial dysautonomia, a number of recessive genes that we have. And the reason we have it in the Ashkenazi community is probably because of what's known as a bottleneck and founder effect. Bottleneck means in a population's history, if you ever get to a time where there are very few people in that population, if you then have a genetic abnormality, and many, by definition, will be marrying each other, right, in a small community, cousins and so on, you'll have an expansion of that clone in which the gene finds itself. We are almost sure that in the 1600s in Europe, there were less than 2 million Jews, right? And therefore, that is a very small community. And so any recessive genetic abnormality, by definition, people will probably be marrying others who are somewhat related to them. And so probably for that, it's called a founder effect. So today in the Jewish community, we have, for example, the Tay-Sachs gene carrier rate is more than 1 in 30. That means somebody in this room sitting here now probably has the gene. In my class at medical school, there were 120 Jews, and we had the class was tested as a research study, and two Ashkenazi Jews in the class turned out to have the Tay-Sachs gene, which is more or less what you'd expect. If one person in 30 has the gene, the random chance of two Ashkenazi Jews marrying each other with the gene is 1 in 30 times 1 in 30, 1 in 900, and 1 in 4 of their children, about 1 in 3,000 babies, will be born with a tragic disease, Tay-Sachs. The children die when they're 2 or 3 years old with a lot of suffering. And it's entirely preventable by making sure that you don't marry someone else who has the same recessive gene that you do. How do we prevent that? So in the old days, I mean, if you're going back before genetic testing, the tragic options were people would marry. Often there would be a child who died tragically or was born with congenital deafness or one of these other or cystic fibrosis, very, very difficult diseases, very painful and a lot of suffering involved. And what would then happen was the couple would then go and have another pregnancy. And in order to diagnose whether the baby had the problem, you would then put a needle into the uterus and test the baby genetically. And of course, that represents a risk to the fetus. It is a problematic question of abortion. Very, very tragic and difficult circumstances. Now, what we can do is test couples before they get married. We can actually test babies genetically in utero as well. Without invasive testing, we can do blood tests. But the main thing to know is that we can prevent these marriages by testing people in advance. 2 more minutes. And therefore, maybe if I speak long enough, they won't force me to do this again. But anyway, the point is that what we do now is we encourage young Jews to be tested during their school years, and so we know if you're carrying a recessive gene. You either do it anonymously, so-called Dor Yesharim, where you're not given the result, or we do it openly, Genetics and J-Screen, many, many genetic programs now, people simply having themselves tested openly and know if you have a abnormal gene. If you do, you choose not to meet somebody who has the same recessive gene, and then, of course, your children will be fine. They may be carriers, like you, but they won't have the disease. In an Orthodox community where people meet by design, this works very well. If you're a secular Jew where you meet your future partner late on a Saturday night in a psychedelic haze, in an institution of dubious standards, then of course it may not work so well. But in our community, where people opt to meet on the basis of previous research, it works very well. Very important to encourage young people. I don't think a Tay-Sachs baby has been born now for a long time because of very good screening methods. We could theoretically actually eliminate the genes, and therefore very important to know that young people should be tested before they consider marriage. Thank you very much for this.
Okay.